Show 21 and a half of Look at His Butt, Helty and JK Talk Trek. For those of you who have been listening to the recent episodes, this is a continuation of our BassCon reporting. It's a little bit short. It mostly focuses on one of our most favorite fanfic writers, Big Miss Sunbeam. So, enjoy!
Space. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
So what is this, round 20 or something?
Of show 20?
Of show 20? 21, it's actually show 21.
Actually, we have graduated through several rounds of competition, and we are now at Fast Money. Welcome to Fast Money!
Fast Money, this is the death match part of it, I think.
Yeah. This combat is to the death. You're fucked.
So with that introduction to this section of the show, we have another very special guest to introduce, and this is somebody that JK and I are meeting for the first time this weekend at BassCon, but we've been fans for years and years and years and years, and regular listeners to our show will remember that we actually read some excerpts from the fabulous TNG episode guide written by Miss Sunbeam, who is our very, very special guest right now.
And she's channeling Marilyn Monroe for us right now.
Oh, happy birthday, Mr. President.
Don't be out of like that.
So we've been just
trailers for cellar rent.
We've been chatting about all kinds of things. We just had a little Shatner marathon here where we watched some young Shatner and some old Shatner, and that was pretty cool.
Yes.
And some gay Shatner.
And some gay Shatner.
And two bad Shatner toupees.
Yes, oh, very bad.
Very, very bad. The gay Shatner, just for those of you who might want to know about this, was an episode of
Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Mother, may I go out to swim?
Yeah.
So the title's gay.
And he was very gay in it.
And he lit two cigarettes and gave one to Mom.
Mom.
Definitely.
He was played by Billy Burke.
Not really, but close.
Still.
Close.
Very close.
So that was fun. We hadn't seen that before.
Yeah, and I think we still have yet more things to watch,
so
which
much.
Is great. So we've been doing these little interviews with people, we've been asking, how did you get into Trek? Number one, like shows, like when did you start watching? And then how did you get into fandom? Two separate questions.
It's a two-part question.
It is. Part one and part two.
And spelling counts.
Okay, well, I have a daughter, one daughter, you know, one sole little child that I love so much. Her name is Susie, also known as That Rat Hole Susie. And so we took her to Six Flags when she was about, this was in 1992. And so she would have been 9 years old in Georgia, and it was raining. So we had to stay inside. We couldn't go to Six Flags. So we didn't really, I know this sounds so incredibly pretentious, we didn't watch TV. So here we were with a TV, and so we were flipping channels.
Were you able to turn it on?
After a while, we called tech support from downstairs.
So you were like Amish.
Amish only, we didn't believe in God, but other than that.
They were Southern Amish.
Southern Amish. And anyhow, I saw Star Trek, The Next Generation. It was the episode where there are the Ferengis, and they open up the egg, and there's Kamala, and she thinks John Luke is so hot, and, you know, like, if you're a random observer, you wouldn't really understand why she thought John Luke was so hot.
But, you know what? That's one of the TNG episodes I really love.
Oh, I love it, too. And see,
isn't it called The Perfect Mate?
It's called The Perfect Mate. And, see, I had been teaching for years, and we always showed this video, this audiovisual, when we didn't want to teach, when we just kind of wanted to smoke cigarettes, of Oedipus Rex, made by the BBC.
You've and seen this?
I've seen it a billion times. Oh, it is like my Rocky Horror Picture Show. And Patrick Stewart plays Oedipus Rex, only I didn't know his name was Patrick Stewart. I just thought, well, it's the guy who plays Oedipus Rex. Yeah, his name was Oedipus Rex. Oedipus Rex. It's a wonderful name. And there he was, and there were Ferengis, and they were so vulgar. And then, you know, Kamala was so in love with him. And so I said, oh, no, wait, don't flip the channels. Let's just watch this for a little while. So my husband and daughter were real contemptuous of me then, as they are now, you know. And I said, oh, this is so great. But, you know, I didn't watch it for another 2 months because I was so ashamed of falling in love so instantly. And then I watched it again, and it was the episode where Bev falls in love with this Romulan who is a defector, and at first he pretends to be merely a subordinate defector, and then we find out that he is a Romulan, like super captain general defector who doesn't want his son to die, so he wants to stop the war, you know, blah 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 blah, dot dot dot, et cetera, et cetera, ellipsis, ellipsis, and anyhow. And then I was in love again. And so it came on every night at 9 o'clock on the little local rat channel. They had all the, like, the Chattanooga sex chat kind of things. And so
we watched. Chattanooga sex
chat. I'm not kidding you. It would have, like, it would have all these girls with really bad teeth going like this, you know, and say, call us up. Call us up now. If you want to talk or chat, just call 1-800. Chattanooga. So anyhow, we were so tickled by it, and I couldn't quit watching it. I could not quit watching it. The only time that I ever had from that time on, at 9 o'clock, for years, for like 7 years, 9 o'clock, every night I would watch Star Trek, The Next Generation. So incredibly in love with Patrick Stewart. I'm not really worthy to say his name. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh.
So were you shunned by the other Amish because of this?
Well, if you're talking about my family, you know, sure. we're totally dysfunctional. So, oh my God. Oh, my husband is so awful. He only saw one episode, and it was the episode where there's the John Luke twin, where John Luke is singing. And it's not really John Luke, it's John Luke's evil twin. And he's so leading everyone 10 forward in song.
Oh, yeah.
And he thinks this is the way they all are. He thinks it's a musical. Oh, let's say Little Gilbert and Sullivan. And so he doesn't really understand this.
So were you not aware of the original series way back when?
Well, I was in college, and I was protesting Vietnam, so I really did not have time to watch television. Mm-hmm. So,
very reasonable.
I was aware of it. Mm-hmm. But it was just television, you know, and serious protesters didn't watch television.
And then when did your love affair with William Shatner begin?
Well, isn't this interesting? I read all about Slash before I ever saw a single episode of TOS.
That is interesting, isn't that?
That's amazing.
And what I read and what really influenced me was Henry Jenkins. Is that his name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what is the name of his book?
Textural Poachers.
And he just said the one little sentence, William Shatner is beautiful. And I thought, oh, William Shatner's not beautiful? This guy is so crazy. This guy is a big crackhead. And then, after all, and the more you watch it, and the more you watch it, the more you realize William Shatner is beautiful. He's really extraordinarily beautiful. And so I came to it wondering if he were beautiful and finding out that he was beautiful. And a lot of it, I know this sounds so dumb, but just fast-forwarding, it's such a beautiful show. It's so graphically beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So the colors, the lighting.
I mean, really, just so incredibly beautiful.
And the costumes, I mean, we've talked about this in reference to 60s TV shows, that clothes were cut so tight on the men, especially. I mean, on the women, you sort of expect it, but the pants were tight, the shirts were tight,
socks were tight, the shoes were tight.
And it was that way on many of the shows at that time. You never see men dressed in clothes that tight, ever.
Oh, except for the Wild Wild West, which is my main fandom now, but that's another story.
So I find that interesting that you knew about Slash before you were watching TOS or getting involved with fandom. So what led you to read Textual Poachers?
I think it was an article I read in the Village Voice. Or if not the Village Voice, maybe New Yorker or something like that.
Was it the review in the New York Times? Because
no.
Lane and I have talked about
it. No, I did not read that
Okay.
I only found out about it about a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay.
So, I don't. I'm really pretty sure it was the Village Voice. And to be honest with you, where I live and the level of really primitive outhouse moonshine sophistication, lard and incest level that I live at, the only way that I ever heard about Slash was through reading the New Yorker, and I never went to cons or anything. I didn't know you could, that people would let me into cons, you know, because of the, you know, the Gomer Pyle kind of thing. And so, you know, I lived in this whole kind of other world of, I've only heard about it. One can only dream about it, where you can actually buy things that tell you that Kirk and Spock are making love. So it was really fairly nice to kind of have this other world I lived in. And when I found it, I mean, it was almost, I'd heard about it. I had read an article in Spy magazine in the spring of, I think it was 98. And they talked about, you know, hey, there's this thing on the internet called Slash. And, like, we looked into it here at Spy Ironic Magazine. And, you know, there's some femme Slash, which is really fabulous. It stars the girls from Friends. And, you know, Courtney Cox discovers Jennifer Aniston in the shower. And it was so hot. So, and then, like, there was this other kind of thing where, like, there was Star Trek. And Worf fucked Wesley so hard that Wesley died. And I thought, oh my God, you can, people, normal people can read this via the internet. And when we got access to the internet later that summer, that was the first thing I did. Almost, my hands almost intuitively went to the word Slash. I mean, this is really quite true. It was beyond my brain. And there it was. And I was
waiting
so impressed.
For you.
It was waiting for me.
So how long did it take from when you started reading Slash to when you started writing Slash?
Well, you know, like the first, say, 3 weeks I read it, I said, oh, I could never write this. I'm not worthy. But it took about 3 weeks, and I started my first Slash.
Do you remember what the first story was that you read?
Read? Oh, yes. It was His Beloved Pet by...
Oh, see, that's
a
classic of TNG.
Oh,
yeah.
It's so fabulous, mm-hmm. Yes. By Ruth and Olara. Uh-huh. I love that story. It made me cry. And everything that I listened or I heard or I thought about after I read that story was colored by it. I would be listening, okay, this is like one of my guilty pleasures, Johnny Horton. I love Johnny Horton. You know, in 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. But now Johnny Horton was colored by PQ, and I could hear Slash in Johnny Horton's voice. I could hear Slash in George, because I listen to a lot of country music.
Me too.
Kind of like it.
I love
and
it.
Everything I did was colored by His Beloved Pet. Everything I heard was in the mirror of His Beloved Pet, you know.
Isn't that funny that everybody we've asked this to, and when we've talked about it, that's like the first story is such a visceral experience, I guess.
It was.
Because I remember going through that, not with PQ, because that wasn't my thing, but that everything suddenly, not just what you saw on TV or not just what you were seeing in stories, but everything you saw, every song you heard.
Every song you heard. Every breath you take. Every move you make.
You know,
every cake you bake.
First love.
It was just, I mean, that was it. Oh, my gosh. It was such a great, I mean, I can remember just what shoes I was wearing. I can remember where I was standing in the hallway where I work when I was thinking about it and saying, oh my God, my life has changed so much for the better. I cannot believe this. You know, and I mean, I'd had a very reasonable life with a husband and child that I still have and all my little pets and my house and my job. But it was like I was transformed. It was a big... what's that old boy's name? William James conversion experience. So that was the way it was.
Yeah. And so then what was the first thing you wrote when you finally said, I can do this?
Well, because I am pretentious and, you know, I can't just do anything. You know, I have to dither. I have to fritter about. I have to make it in a larger cultural context. Okay, so... I wrote a story called A Soldier's Story, And there had been an article in the New Yorker. Obviously, I have a really limited, pathetic life. I started reading the New Yorker. It was about an actual archaeological discovery called Kennewick Man. And Kennewick Man was a skull that he discovered about 10,000 years old in Oregon. And it was a Caucasian skull. And the guy who discovered it said, you know, like, if you could flesh this out, it would look just like Patrick Stewart.
Did he really?
Yeah, you can look it up on the internet. Oh, Kennewick Man, K-E-N-N-E-W-I-C-K. And it does. When they put the flesh on it, the way they do that restoration of skulls. And it's kind of a controversy because, of course, Native American tribes, when it returned for proper burial, because for a long time Indian skulls were regarded as souvenirs, and you understand their sensitivity. But the problem is, the skull was Caucasian. Mm-hmm. It was 10,000 years old and Caucasian. So I thought, well, what if that was Q's gift to Picard? Picard loves archaeology. So what if they get married and they shack up and all that kind of stuff. And then when Picard dies, because he's mortal, the great final gift is to make Picard a great archaeological mystery.
Wow.
And so Canuck is like Neanderthal for Jean-Luc.
That's so true. Oh, I mean, I did all my research.
You know, I'm sure you did.
Because this is the kind of girl I am. I'm a research girl. So.
Wow, that's great. And you have been responsible for two things I think most people know you for. Well, maybe three things.
Ooh!
One of them is Promised Land.
Yes.
Which is huge. How long did it take you to write that?
A year and a half.
How many pages is it, do you know?
Well, it depends on how big the font is.
Well, the version you sent to me, the spiral-bound version, is like 8.5 by 11 pages that have a fair amount of text on each page.
How many pages? About 800?
Something like that. It's massive. It's really huge.
It's, this sounds real pathetic. Like, I wrote it while my parents were dying. But I didn't write it while my parents were dying. But, they had a good death. You know, they were old. They were supposed to die. And I had to drive up every 2 weeks, a four-hour trip, four-hour back. I just had a lot of time to think. And so I wanted to think about something reassuring. Mm-hmm. So this little fantasy world of Promised Land, of jailhouse prostitution and fisting.
It was
such a secure world.
That was so reassuring for you.
It was a very secure world to retreat to. Mm-hmm. And, where people were tortured daily. Mm-hmm. And, it was so happy. It made me so happy. And that, such a reassuring. Well, Mama and Daddy were dying.
It's an amazing story. There's so much in that story. And it takes the characters that you see on TNG and recasts them.
Yeah.
Because it's still them, but it's them as somebody else. And there are parts of the characters in there. There are some of the actors in there as well. It's like just an amazing job of transporting them into this.
Yeah, I was very proud of it because I took actual interviews with Patrick Stewart and I put them in as interviews with the character because I'd made them into bluegrass singers, mm-hmm. which I thought was a completely fabulous idea. Obviously, I mean, only a lunatic would think it's a fabulous idea. Oh, they're great. They're people in outer space. Let's make them bluegrass singers. Is that great? How great is that? And then I would give Patrick Stewart interviews to the characters, and I was very pleased with myself.
Now, were you writing before you started writing fan fiction?
No.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You're such a good writer.
And you have such a wonderful way with words.
Well, I did a lot of private writing. I would do pensées and diaries and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I would do things like, I'm a devout Catholic. You must understand that. And so during Lent, sometimes I would say, I must write a page a day. And one time I decided that I would write a page a day not using the letter E. And trying to write about, because I write memories, and I tried to write about Kent State, what happened at Kent State, because I was in college then. It was a very big deal to me, without using the letter E, which is pretty interesting. You use Ohio a lot, and we talk about that.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's like high-level writing exercises.
Yeah, really. And it was just me because nobody, you know, I have no friends. God, I'm so sad.
The other thing that I think a lot of people probably know you for is Anybody's Night, just because you gasp when I say that.
No, I love that so much.
But I remember when you first posted that, it caused a huge flurry of stuff around it just because of all the different characters that were in it. And people were like, they were gasping when they read. They were gasping
They didn't give me any feedback. I didn't know they were gasping.
Well,
they were out of breath.
Yeah.
They couldn't send feedback because they were, like, you know, fish flopping around on the floor.
This is a pathetic confession, but I always had this idea that I was going to do graphic novels. Uh-huh. And I had a character, and she was basically a Mary Sue, and her name is Blood Sugar. And she dresses like Liza Minnelli in Cabaret, and her name is Blood Sugar. And she has various adventures, and one of them is that she goes to a nightclub where it's anybody's night at Oscar's Egyptian Cabaret. And so you have all this great King Tut stuff. It's basically everything I love. You know, it's a nightclub where there's nothing I don't love. And so there's the sorcerer figure from the Cave of the Twofwares from 25,000 B.C. And Oscar Wilde is there. And I don't know, everybody I love. I can't remember who all's in the story now.
Oh, there's like 50 characters.
Yeah. Rhett Butler and Ashley Wilkes have an affair, but they both confess they both fucked Mammy. And then they go into hysterics. One of my favorite slash pairings that no one else has really exploited, Walt Whitman slash Bill Clinton, when Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. You know, big, beautiful boy that Bill Clinton is, and Walt Whitman is just so enamored of him. And so... Yeah, and so, I mean, I put my heart into it.
Because
I had actually written that years before without any reference to John Lukanen. But I was a big U2 fan, and so I made U2 the busboys at the restaurant. And they were going around cleaning up after everybody, and I was thinking, golly, wouldn't it be neat if there were no copyright laws, and you could just, like, put everything into a story you wanted to? Like Oscar Wilde and U2 and Bill Clinton and Walt Whitman. Oh, Herman Melville was there. Herman Melville. Oh, it was so great because there was a foursome later on between Herman Melville and John Luke and Johnny Horton, big Johnny Horton fan, and me. Oh, yeah, I was in it too. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So there was a foursome. We all four had sex. Me, Herman Melville, John Luke, and Johnny Horton.
My hat's off to you, girl.
We couldn't get enough of each other, baby. No, wait a minute. I'm wrong. Because Akhenaten, the first monotheist, was also in on that. So maybe it was a fivesome. And because I just thought these were the greatest people on earth. Uh-huh. They changed the world. And V.I. Lennon was in it, too. And one time I was talking... I know I'm talking too much, but my husband was talking to me, and he said something about Elvis Presley. Of course, I love Elvis more than I love life itself, but I thought he said Melville's Presley, like Herman Melville's Presley. So Melville's Presley, oh, what a fabulous idea. It's just like a revision of Billy Budd, Melville's Presley. So Melville's Presley was a character in my graphic novel that's still in my mind, which I will write someday. And it's called Blood Sugar. And Blood Sugar, it's like Blood Sugar explains the world to you. Blood Sugar has no superpowers like me, but she has a super weakness. And her super weakness is that she is Cassandraic. I made that word up because she can see the future, but no one believes her. And so I think that's a fabulous weakness.
Yeah.
And so she's going around saying, you know, what we're doing is wrong. And there's like Blood Sugar explains the Russian Revolution. Blood Sugar goes to Oscars, anyone not. Blood Sugar explains television because I have this vision that there's television and the best television is the television you can't control. And like there's a, you know, you can just start the television, and it might plug into a Polish channel where you can't understand the language. But you're stuck with it the way we were when I was growing up, because you were stuck with three channels mm-hmm. when I was growing up. And there's something about that that's sort of an interesting thing about life, mm-hmm. rather than being in control as you are now.
Yes, definitely. The third thing that people know you for is the TNG episode guide, which is a review / commentary on every single episode of TNG. How many is that altogether?
Billion, what is it, 173?
I was going to say it's close to 200, yeah. Which is just truly amazing to me. And the commentary that you've written is so incredibly funny, because sometimes it really is a summary of the episode. Sometimes it has nothing to do with the episode, and in those cases it's actually far better than watching the episode itself. But you've thrown in so many different cultural references and observations about the characters and the actors that are just right on target, and you've done it in such a pithy way.
That's amazing. What I was going to say. Your own voice comes through so clearly. I mean, it's not by any means a vanilla funny episode.
Have I died and gone to heaven with all these people saying these nice things to me? My goodness.
We're generally nice to our guests.
Oh. But as most people who listen to our show will know, if we don't like something, we say we don't like it. So
right. We're
not given to false flattery. One of my what I did with this, because it's a huge document, it's pages and pages and pages. I took it and I turned it into a document that I could put onto my portable electronic book. And I have it on there, and I take that with me when I go on long trips. And I had to go to France, and after I'd had dinner and everything, I was sitting in my little hotel room in Paris reading your episode guide, my little electronic book reader, and laughing my ass off. I mean, sitting there going, wah!
I don't even have a passport. I'm like Gomer Pyle. That's amazing.
So the episode guide has gone where you have not.
Yes, boldly.
It has traveled.
It's everywhere. So for people who are fans of TNG, you must read this episode guide. You just can't survive without reading it, because it will change the way you look at everything that happens in there. And it will inspire you to think about it in a completely new way.
And it's all from the heart.
Because
that was the first Star Trek that I ever watched. Mm-hmm. And I was just hooked immediately. And I was particularly hooked on Patrick Stewart. See, I'm really not worthy to say his name. So, you know, Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah.
Captain Picard.
You've seen him in I, Claudius, right?
No, actually I haven't.
You never saw him in I, Claudius? Oh, my God.
How do you access I, Claudius?
It used to be on PBS all the time.
Yeah, but it's been a while since.
But it's probably on DVD.
I bet it's on Netflix. Netflix.
The only bad thing about him, he's very good in it, of course. Is that they gave him a terrible wig.
I heard that.
So it looks like Hair Club for Roman Centurions, basically. So it's not too flattering. But he's very good in his Patrick Stewart-y way. And he's slightly swishy in that, although he's supposed to be a straight character. He's wonderful. You must see it.
Oh, I will. I'll put it on Netflix.
Yeah. So as part of your section of the show, we were hoping you would read a little bit of your fabulous episode guide.
Well, I will read about my favorite episode, which is episode 62, Yesterday's Enterprise. And if you're into the whole Star Trek The Next Generation pudding, you know about this, because this is the one where they go back in time and there's all this stuff that happens, and then they
plot, plot, plot,
blah, blah, plot, dot, 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 and then they get back, you know, because they do stuff. And that's the way it works.
And that, you know what? That's like the level of time travel story I like.
Yeah.
Dot, 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 and then they get back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And they do stuff, with so much emotion that time doesn't matter. You know, I feel this so strongly. The clock doesn't really, is stopped or sped up or whatever. So it's called Yesterday's Enterprise. And it was like the Star Trek, you know, that whole jump the shark thing?
Mm-hmm.
And see, the first two seasons, it really, Star Trek, The Next Generation, rode with the shark. And you just wondered when it was going to jump the shark. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, in the third season, it just came into its own.
Mm-hmm.
It became the most fabulous show in America. And, I mean, really, it was like oxygen. You couldn't go anywhere without it. And it was so fabulous. And that's the crowning jewel of the third season.
Well,
is Yesterday's Enterprise, which I have written, champion bestest enterprise of all time. See, John Luke and them are all messing around, as they always do, and they go through a temporal rift where they're 20 years in the past, and the Klingons are mopping the floor with the Federation, and it's all kind of an AU, i.e. alternate universe, and everyone's nerves are on edge, and it's really sexy, and John Luke has to snarl at Riker, which we all want to do, right, because we all hate Riker for being such a big freelance pussy, and Barkeep Guinan is acting battle strategist. Whoopi Goldberg is so wonderful. You can see how Guinan persuades John Luke that she's right, because basically she's a, you know, she runs the bar, and she keeps wandering around saying, this isn't right. This isn't right. We're not supposed to be in this universe. And John Luke believes her, even though she just runs the bar. It's such a fabulous moment. And the greatest moment is one which repudiates all you TOSers, all you original series people who say that John Luke is a social worker and a big femme and a girly cow that goes moo-moo, because, which they do. There's always been this hostility. Oh, Shatner's a real hero. John Luke's a social worker, because at an analogous moment when Shatner's, well, Kirk's son was killed, and Kirk just kind of wanders around the captain's chair saying, those bastards killed my son. Those bastards killed my son. My man, John Luke, leaps over the edge of the captain, the whole little, kind of little captain's area, and says to the Klingons who want him to surrender, that will be the day, cocksuckers. He doesn't really say cocksuckers, but I mean, that's what he means. I mean, he grabs up a machine gun, and he says, that'll be the day, cocksuckers, and proceeds to machine gun his way back to the real time. Words can do no justice to this particular ep. I mean, it's just so fabulous. I mean, John Luke is so great.
Oh, that's great.
And so John Luke basically becomes Rambo.
Well, I mean, no, he just has strength when he has to have strength. Rambo just wanders around, I have muscles all the time. John Luke only has muscles when he needs to, which is a real hero. Other than that, he's very tender.
I have to ask you a question. Do you really have a big cardboard Riker?
Yes, I do. I have a big cardboard Riker. My niece bought it for me. It's a Christmas present. And and so, you know, we actually don't. We finally, after a while, we threw it away. But for years, we had the big cardboard Riker.
So big cardboard Riker was standing out in your trash when the garbage man came by?
Is that... I know that was odd for them, but... Oh, do you think that was the first time our trash was weird? Do you think the garbage men were so astonished? All our other trash was so normal?
So, now, did you actually invent a drink called...
Yeah, and exactly.
So, tell
What's
me what goes
it?
In a big
What's
cardboard
in a big
Riker.
Cardboard Riker?
Okay, blue curacao is Ooh. The main thing. And, you know, some sugar syrup. And if you can find a little plastic trumpet or trombone.
Oh, trombone, yeah.
And put it in there. Like, you know, you go to a party store.
Oh, yeah.
And you find a little plastic instrument of some kind, and you put it in there. And, you know, maybe a little fruit of some sort. And there you go. There's your big cardboard Riker.
Well, I wish we had a round of those right
I
now.
I know.
Oh,
that'd
yeah.
be great. Big cardboard Riker.
Yeah, I didn't have any money, and it was my husband's birthday. And so I said, well, I'll make him a gift. And so I made him this bar guide, and we had all these things. Like, I know this is horrible. I'm such a horrible person. But we, you know, Richard Speck.
Yeah.
You have a drink for Richard Speck?
We do, because only one person survived the Richard Speck mass murder. It was a Filipino nurse. And she was so unnerved that when the cops came, she said, there's trouble on the sampan. She was so unnerved, so I have a drink called Trouble on the Sampan. I know, that's awful. I'm going to go to hell. I mean, I can feel hell's flames licking to my feet.
Save from seats.
Yeah, because we'll be there right after you. Yeah.
So, and a lot of things like that. And then, like, little weird personal things that, you know, about when... My husband and I got married. My mother was the most emotional person on earth. Went around and asked everyone at the wedding, "Does she know this man?" So we had a drink called "Does she know this man?" Does she know this man?
Because you know that is a really good name for a drink.
Does she know this man? Because see, I just gotten it's a long story, you know, like all life is a long story. I'd just gotten divorced, and my mother thought I was marrying on the rebound. I don't think she's right about, but because it's last 25 years. So
you never know, though. Could be over tomorrow.
Do you really know him?
No, I don't.
Yeah. And you know what? It's probably the secret of the success of the thing.
I don't know this man.
But he's an interesting stranger, so I'll hang around for a while.
Do you know this man? I mean, I think that's a compliment. Do you know this man? You know, my mother was flinging herself into people's arms. Does she know this man? Does she know this man? So there was a drink like that. So, you know, I mean, we have a lot of little jokes. Oh, one with the strapping-filled hand, which had molasses in it, and et cetera.
So have you made and imbibed all these drinks?
We actually didn't make any of the drinks. We just, it was the idea, the concept that mattered.
I think that's wonderful.
Oh, and the name of the little drinks book was Put Some Gin in It This Time, because I would always get mad at him because he would make drinks and I would think that he just didn't put any liquor in them. So put some gin in it this time. And so this is also kind of our family motto. Put some gin in it this time.
See, that's like the opposite of me. I for a long time, until I started drinking Manhattans when I got serious about liquor, I drank really, really weak drinks. And so when my husband would make drinks, I'd always say, don't make mine so strong. And he would say, yeah, I know, I'm making you a pussy drink. So I was always having pussy drinks.
Yeah, I won't. And my husband's the exact opposite, you know. Put some gin in it this time. Quit screwing around. Come on, I want liquor. Just bring the bottle out here and I'll do it. Come on.
That's wonderful. Thanks for spending so much time talking with us. We'll have to do this more often.
It's been so great, not just to have you on the show, but to finally meet you here at the con. This is our first time meeting Big Miss Sunbeam.
Oh.
And it has been an honor to have your rays of light shining on us right before you go straight to hell and save us. Did somebody stuff some pantyhose in your mouth?
Not yet. Well, the evening is still young.
It's true. Who knows what will happen.